The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Hindsight is 20/20. It's so great to be able to see things in retrospect and to say, oh, if I had only known then what I know now. If some of the child psychologists who advocated the swinging of the pendulum from discipline to total permissiveness and progressive education back in the 40s and 50s could listen to some of the products of that kind of teaching, they might get a little bit of an education themselves. Because now it begins to appear that somebody may have leapt to an extreme back during those days of no spanking, no, pardon the expression, corporal punishment for children in the home or in the school or institution. And now they're beginning to realize that this mountainous tidal wave of child crime, which threatens the big cities and the small towns alike of the United States and Canada, this mountainous threat of mugging, of rape, robbery, burglary, murder, arson, being perpetrated by mere youths, 11, 12, 13, 15, 16, and do you know that the highest representative age category for murder in the United States is age 16? 16 to 18, you can account for 40 to 50% of all major crimes in these ages. Now they're beginning to realize, facing this as a matter of a product, or the fruits of the kind of child-rearing, or better said, the lack of it, that maybe something was wrong with the approach Americans and Canadians were being given by some of the ultra-libertine teachings in various famous magazines which are aimed at parents, and books by psychologists and educators trying to tell us how to rear our children. Well, in a case history of social workers talking with child after child who had run afoul of the law, the kids, in retrospect, are saying in their mid and late teens how they wish their parents would have taught them. And you know, in almost every single case, the way the kids say they really wanted it when they were young is the exact opposite of what the child psychologist has said. We're the factory and the kids are the product. That's all there is to it. The product that comes out of a factory is shaped by the mold, the form, the design of the engineers, the people who made the machine tools that bent the metal and formed the plastic in that particular shape. That's the way you recognize the model of a car, a foreign import, or some automobile made in the United States or Canada. And when you see a hostile, rebellious, resentful kid who would just as soon kill a cop, or a pig, as he may call him, as look at him, you are looking at a result. You're looking at an effect of an underlying cause. You're looking at the product of a factory. And that factory is the home, the parent. Sometimes, and all too often in our society, is only one parent that is present there in that home, because somewhere around a third or more, if you're talking about some of the big city areas, of our homes in the United States, and not quite so much in Canada, but to a very large extent, and more than should be so, are ripped asunder these days by divorce. About a quarter or more of the labor force in the United States is female. A tremendous percentage of those are divorcees, or working mothers who have to farm out their children to day schools, nurseries, kindergartens, and preschools, and this type of thing, and more or less ask some institution to take the responsibility to rear their child in the most important of all years, the formative years, while they, because they would be in their 20s and early 30s, and therefore in the most energetic and viable years for their wage-earning capacity. The 25 to 44-year age group is called the wage-earning, the very muscle of society so far as the age brackets are concerned, of the wage-earning capacity of people. And so it follows that working mothers would tend to be younger mothers, not up in their 40s and 45s and 50s so much as in their teens, 20s and 30s. And here you have a tremendous number of hundreds of thousands of working mothers whose children are somebody else's responsibility. Now, this social worker at a correctional center in Ontario, Canada, developing quite a rapport with a large number of young people who had run afoul of the law, began to really get the confidence of a lot of these kids, and began to really unload about the way they wish it had been when they were living life with their parents. Unfortunately, though, he is talking of an idealistic situation where both parents might have been present, where dad was there and mom was there. And so for the present, in talking about this situation, I'm having to deal with what the kids said themselves. And the beauty of this is that instead of talking down to anyone, of taking some precept off the shelf or some philosophical concept out of a book or even the Bible and telling you, this is what the Bible says, I am reporting to you what hundreds of youngsters said to social workers when these youngsters had been arrested for some of the major crime categories, and they were asked, what would you do differently? What do you think parents should have done when you were coming up? If you had any advice for parents based upon your own experiences, what would it be? So it's almost entirely hindsight. Well, last time I was telling you there were about seven. Actually, it turns out about nine or more, but I'll go as long as I need to cover them all. But in the meantime, I'd like to repeat the first three, because we left off with the third, didn't really have time to discuss it very well. The kid said, first, keep cool. Don't lose your temper in the crunch, and keep the lid on when things go wrong. Kids need the reassurance that comes from controlled responses. And I commented that so many parents are themselves juvenile. That means that they are emotionally unstable and immature. And this is so obvious, especially when you're talking about hasty teenage marriages, about half of which break up in the first year, and about 80 or 90% of which break up in about 5 years, and the chances for success are almost minimal or marginal, if any. And so it's no wonder that when kids do anything from choke the canary to death to spill the cereal bowl, that sometimes young, uneducated, untrained parents themselves, having seen perhaps a very poor parental example, simply blow their minds and decide to beat the kid after that. Well, some of those cases become sensationalized crimes in themselves. And as I said last time, the beating of a child, the injury of a child, or even the death of a child, which unfortunately has occurred from time to time, has sometimes resulted in the swinging of the pendulum to the opposite extreme, and then they begin to advocate no discipline and no punishment whatsoever. Well, either one is an extreme. The one is an absolute crime, should never be done. No punishment, no discipline should ever be administered in an emotional state, nor should a beating, for that matter. So the kids themselves tell parents, will you please keep cool? Keep control of your temper. Keep the lid on in the crunch. And when things go wrong, kids need reassurance that come from controlled responses. The second point they made was, don't get strung out. This is their language, from too much booze or too many pills. When we see our parents reaching for those crutches, we get the idea that nobody goes out there alone, that it's perfectly okay to go for a bottle or a capsule when things get heavy. Remember, your children are great imitators, the kid said, and we lose respect for parents who tell us to behave one way while they behave another way. And that is, as I said, an old adage a lot of people think is going to work. Don't do as I do as I say do. You might be able to get away with that in the military or corporate structure, but you can't get away with it where your kids are concerned, because they are great imitators. Your kids will begin to imitate the way you talk about the traffic cop who pulls in behind you in traffic. If you're black and your child first has an encounter with a young white kid, you begin talking about Uncle Charlie, you can expect your child to grow up with that kind of a complex. If you use that abominable term that the blacks hate for a black, or the slang term that the whites use, you begin to tell your white child, yeah, them are the so's and so's, you're going to have a guaranteed racial bigot on your hands. He's going to bend the way you bend him. He's going to be shaped the way you shape him. He's going to imitate and follow your example. You know, the Archie Bunkers of the world are real. That's why so many millions laugh at the program and the series, the sitcoms of television and the movies. Because these are real life circumstances. There are people that are that bigoted. I'd like to take time out for just a moment for a commercial and come back and tell you something about a situation that obtains even in Ambassador College, where it has to do with interracial dating and with the feelings of some young black people, and how it is that we, in running a college and dealing with teenagers, have to be very cognizant of the fact that there are really a lot of Archie Bunkers in the world.
When a teenager is apprehended by the police for a crime, bewildered parents and relatives often comment that he was always such a good boy, or that he came from a good home. Why do good homes produce criminals? Why do children who have everything turn to crime? What unseen factors turn that baby a young couple wanted into a villain wanted by the police? Are some children born to be criminals? In a home where long-range concern for the child is neglected, the result is not a mature, responsible adult human being. To learn more about this and to help protect your child's future, be sure to request The Plain Truth About Child Rearing, a practical guide to parenthood. Your copy is free of charge. Request and read The Plain Truth About Child Rearing. Both you and your child will be glad you did. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. Again, that's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.
I've never seen it fail when you put a group of kids together that are little tiny kids that are completely unconscious of sex differences and of race differences. They just don't care. You can let them play together. They're just unaware and oblivious of the idea there ought to be tensions or there ought to be fears, there ought to be feelings of inferiority or superiority. They play together happily, completely unconscious of sex, of racism, of religious or philosophical or cultural differences or disagreements. But, you know, we have to train these kids so that eventually by the time they're good teenagers, 16, 17, and they've got some hard and fast ideas, they're pretty well settled already about the way their lives are going to go, we, the parents, have managed to put a lot of ideas into their heads with which they're going to live and cope and grapple the rest of their natural lives. Well, you know, at Ambassador College, we're fully integrated. We have all races, Arabs, Jews, blacks, Orientals, whites, and so on. I don't know whether we're just about nationally balanced in the sense of having the ratio very small, colleges of very few hundreds, of course, but we're very heavily represented, certainly by the blacks of our society and by Chicanos or Mexican-Americans, people of that parentage, Oriental, and as I said, Jew, Arab, Ukrainian, Middle Eastern Arab countries of different types, and so on. We have to be aware that these young people do not naturally these days, especially in the wake of the civil rights movement, of the many campus riots, of the new freedoms that young people have been searching and striving for, that these young people would rather intermingle socially in a large, like a dance or a sing-along or a picnic or a cookout or something of this nature without a lot of racial feelings or tensions. Now, we do not, either biblically based, philosophically or spiritually based, encourage, as a matter of fact, we totally discourage miscegenation. That is marriage across racial bounds. We do so because of social phenomena and because of the unbelievable number of cases available to us from people to contact those within or without a church environment who are being counseled for spiritual purposes, who will tell you by the hundreds of cases that when they married across very obvious and sometimes the more extremes of the racial lines, that they were accepted by neither part of their society and that their children were ridiculed, embarrassed, and hated. It was very, very difficult for them. We have to be cognizant then of accepting the responsibility of these young people. That because there are some Archie Bunkers in the world, if we find that there seems to be an undue amount of interest developing which might lead to miscegenation or interracial marriage, we get the parents involved. We simply say, look, maybe there's some guy out there somewhere who might be so bigoted, who might be so filled with racial intolerance and hatred, he would end up trying to sue the college. So we always try, whether you're talking about the very idealistic situation of peoples within different races, whether you're talking of black or Chicano or Oriental or white or Jewish or Arab, there are, you know, just because they're the same race, there might be a thousand reasons why some people aren't meant for each other. And it's all the more obvious when they marry across racial lines. Well, I'm going to get some hate mail maybe from somebody who just feels interracial marriage is the ideal state. We ought to go back to the old Babylonian idea of the amalgamation of the races, but I'll just go ahead and say in advance, don't bother, because I'll disagree with you if you write the letter. But we do get the parents involved because we feel that's where it's at. The parents are responsible. And if parents want their children to date across racial lines and to marry across racial lines, it is their responsibility. It is the individual's responsibility. And so that's where we let it lie. Well, you know, we don't have to have future little Archie Bunkers being ushered into the world. You don't have to have bigots who don't even know what a communist is or what communism stands for, but who do nothing but ascribe every evil they can think of to crime. For instance, a lot of people would tell you that youth crime is a conspiracy by all these communists. A lot of people don't even know how to pronounce the word. They know less about what communism is, what it stands for. I say it's the avowed enemy of the United States and all free people. Sure it is, because I've researched enough about communism and even written a great deal on it to know. But to say that there is some vast conspiracy that is at the door of the communists, as some people would like to say, the blacks, as other people would like to say, the Jewish bankers, moneylenders, and the Rothschilds, as other people would like to say, and that everything you can see these interesting little proofs that there is a giant conspiracy, is absolutely ridiculous. But there are people who will stand there and tell you as if they know what they're talking about, that all of our media, all entertainment, comics, literature, movies, television series, are all deliberately being manipulated by the communists to try to pervert and destroy the American youth. Nonsense. We're doing a good enough job as lackadaisical, lethargic, ill-equipped, poorly prepared and trained parents of destroying our own youth without the communists helping us out. And don't we realize that the communist structure society is very strongly oriented toward a strong family structure and toward strong family discipline, and that basically a communistic society eschews drink and drugs and juvenile delinquency, and they are just now beginning to have to cope with some of the problems of the so-called free enterprise systems of the capitalistic West. So those that would like to dwell in ignorance are themselves products of ignorant parents, I believe, and it's time that everybody got himself a little more educated. You can produce an Archie is a good way to say it, maybe, but not accurate. Archie Bunker, the bigots of our day that we laugh at, by being a bigot yourself. You don't have to educate your kid. Every time you hear something come on television you don't like, sound off about it with some prejudicial, volatile, highly prejudicial, personalized, and polarized statement. That'll get your kid to be as big a bigot as, I'm going to say you, because, I mean, there's got to be somebody somewhere that might be. But at any rate, if you're talking about the policeman, if you're talking about politicians, talking about what you read in the newspapers, all of your own prejudices, all of your own feelings, whether it's racism or what, is going to come right out of your mouth, right into your kids' heads, and you're going to be able to be a better teacher by doing that, by teaching your kids all these things, than any formal education could ever correct. No matter what a wonderful school system, and are there any of those, to which your child could go, if you are busily educating a bigot at home, a prejudiced bigot, you're putting racial and racist ideas in his head, and various untrue political polarities into his mind, and suspicions and hatreds and jealousies and contempt of other people, selfishness and self-righteousness into his mind. No amount of formal education is ever going to do a better job than you as a parent in your off moments, in your unguarded, relaxed moments, are doing. Not consciously, but unconsciously. So when you look back, you're always tempted to ask, when you see a youngster that is brought before the police for murder, or arson, or rape, auto theft, drug abuse, you're always wanting to go back and say, well, what was your family life like? And what was your family background? And where did you come from? You're amazed to find that it can transcend social or economic or racial areas. That they can come from the finest homes. But, you know, that is a qualified statement, because nearly always when you say finest homes, you're talking about the standing of the father and the mother in the community. You're talking about their socioeconomic standing. You're talking about a man in business and a woman that has her own job, but you may not be talking at all about what kind of a home environment they had as parent, between parent and child in a parent-child relationship. Well, in just a moment, I'll come back and give you some of the rest of what the kids themselves say we as parents ought to be like.
For 40 years, the Plain Truth magazine has been supplying the missing dimension in education. The Plain Truth is published monthly as a facet of Ambassador College's In the Home Educational Service. It maintains an editorial policy that incorporates this missing dimension in education, biblical understanding. The Plain Truth, timely, informative articles deal with subjects covering success in business, recreation, politics, religion, farming. Each issue not only documents the state of today's society, but offers hope for a better world tomorrow. To serve its more than 6 million readers, The Plain Truth is published in 5 languages and is available without price or obligation to all who request it. Join the growing worldwide readership. Request your subscription to the magazine with a 40-year history of educational service to mankind. The Plain Truth. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
You know, the kids themselves say they don't want parents to come down to their level. The only time that I think parents ought to do that is when they do it physically, in a sense of getting down on their carpet and playing around with the kids when they're of the age you can do that kind of thing. But beyond that, the teenagers say they don't want a parent off that pedestal where they, the teenager, would like to put them. They say it this way in their own words: don't blow your class. Keep the dignity of parenthood. Stay on that pedestal. Your children have put you there because they need someone to look up to. Don't try to dress, dance, or talk like your kids. You embarrass us and you look ridiculous. That's what they said. On a comment or two here about dressing. You know, it took the kids, like beginning with the Beatles, when they originally were called the Mopheads, if you recall back that long ago, after Elvis was gradually being phased out and the Beatles were phased in, and we had what was known as Beatlemania when they first began to visit the United States, and it suddenly became an exciting thing to see young people wearing hair that looked like, which one of the Three Stooges was it? That is, haircut with the, you know, cereal bowl type of haircut. Well, it went from that to the long hair, and so everybody began galloping along, following a leader, class and status and symbolic consciousness of having a kind of a sign of rebellion. I knew at that time, and I said publicly time and time again, go ahead, kids, as long as you're leading in the wrong direction, you can expect the adult generation to follow you. And sure enough, they did. Little by little, we began seeing entertainers, comedians, people up into their 60s and 70s, walking around growing long hair. The kids don't like it, folks. They just don't like it. You know, now you see religionists and politicians and others doing it, letting their locks grow a little longer because they want to be in, whatever that means, and they want to relate to the youth, whatever. The youth says that when older people, when their parents, and they look upon parents as being a remote generation so far removed, it's pitiful if we could just wake up and realize that, when they try to dress and affect youthful modes and ways of speech and hair and clothing styles, it embarrasses the young people. Yet I see lots of people in their 50s running around with a body shirt and a big medallion, acting like he thinks he's 16. But I'll just tell you what the kids say, for whatever it's worth. If you want to disagree with them, well, then that's your privilege. But that's what they say. The next point, they said, point number four, bug us a little. Be strict and consistent in dishing out discipline. Call our bluff. Make it clear that you mean what you say. Don't be wishy-washy. And they said, lukewarm answers make us uneasy. Show us who's boss. It gives us a feeling of security to know we've got some strong support under us. In this booklet on the plain truth about childbearing, there's quite a segment in here about how criminal behavior is learned and about the so-called mythical phases of childhood that they go through. And some of the quotations I want to tell you about, one in particular here in the early part of the book, are kind of interesting. These are from some of the child psychology books, and some of those that I've talked about in the past as being authored by people who sent, such as Dr. Spock, have begun to admit that some of what they earlier said was not quite accurate. At 2.5 years, said one book of the supposed stages through which children are supposed to develop, they say this is an age about which parents may need warning, because so much that the child now does naturally, almost inevitably, is directly contrary to what his parents would like to have him do. The 2.5-year-old is not, temperamentally, an easily adaptable member of any social group. The change in behavior which takes place between 2 and 2.5 can be rather overwhelming. Imagine that. The parents now are being warned. You observe this little kid here. And in about 6 months' time, from 2 to 2.5, the change that takes place in him is liable to be so overwhelming, you'll have a tough time coping with it. Perhaps to the child, as well as to the adults who surround him, 2.5 is a peak age of disequilibrium. Parents often say they can't do a thing with a child of his age. Can't do a thing with him. Can't tell him when to get up, when to go to bed, when to eat, when to lie down, when to go to the bathroom, when to take a shower, when to come in, anything. First of all, a 2.5-year-old is rigid and inflexible. I say to that, to the author, you want to bet? But anyhow, that's what they say. Rigid and inflexible. He wants exactly what he wants when he wants it. He cannot adapt, give in, wait a little while. Everything has to be done just so. Everything has to be in the right place. He considers its proper place. I've never known of a 2.5-year-old in my entire life that considered putting everything in its proper place. You go into a 2.5-year-old's room after you leave him in there for a couple hours playing, and that's its proper place? But this guy authored a book and said that's the way it is. For any domestic routine, He sets up a rigid sequence of events which must follow each other always in the same manner. Now, I'm telling you, that opening statement has got to be the understatement of the year when it says that he nearly always does directly contrary to what his parents would like to have him do. That sounds like you got Mussolini resurrected, coming home to live with you. That sounds like Adolf Hitler, suddenly 2.5 years old, sitting there on your living room carpet. He wants everything done exactly when he's ready to have it done exactly as he says. So there's no question at all as you read these books about who's in charge here. I mean, there's no question at all about who's running the house, if you're going to follow that kind of advice, that is. So the idea is that if parents can get him to adapt, they may run the risk of breaking his spirit, but they should try, maybe. The approach that they gave here on page 15 is in this booklet about surrounding a child with interesting things to keep him from running into the street. They talk about how maybe a little foray into the street, not too bad, but maybe you ought to surround him with other interesting things. You wouldn't ever want to spank a kid running across the street with trucks and cars and so on screeching to a halt, because if you discipline the child, you might break his spirit. Of course, if the truck hits him, it's going to break more than his spirit, but the only equipment, the only tools that some of these psychologists are going to give parents is surrounding kids with objects that are more interesting to play with than guns and knives and bottles of poison and gas jets and matches. Now, if you could tell me, and anybody could send in to me, the toy that has ever been designed that is more interesting to play with than some of these dangerous objects that are around the home, including mom's bric-a-brac, I'd like to know what in the world it is. Well, this booklet does take issue with some of that type of statement, and it does show you the proper methods of child training and discipline. It shows how to be consistent, now, always to speak the same thing. It talks about parents, about the home, about the rules, really, that are just common sense. And, incidentally, does quote a fair amount of the Bible. So the kids, in retrospect, looking back, say, give us discipline. Call our bluff. Stay up there on the pedestal where you belong. Set us the right example. Don't do one thing and preach another. Some pretty good common sense coming from teenagers, freely given to social workers who were trying to rehabilitate young teenagers who had been on drugs, who had perpetrated serious crimes, who had gotten in trouble with the law, who in some cases had gone to jail. And the kids say, with hindsight, which is 2020, in looking back and saying, what was it that made you do the things you did? Where do you think you went wrong? What could your parents have done to have made things differently? These are some of the things they say. And they disagree diametrically, the opposite. They disagree with what the child psychologists try to tell you. Write for these twin booklets on Crime Can Be Stopped, Here's How, and the booklet on the plain truth about child rearing. I've been able to quote from this, to utilize it for many, many years since that intensive study, when I was going home night after night, and this for a portion of many years of my life, with arms laden with books from the public library, some of the most mind-bending quotations I've ever heard in all of my life, that are given to you in this booklet, or book really, it's more of a thick book about the size of a Reader's Digest magazine, The Plain Truth About Child Rearing. And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.